So according to the Wikipedia entry on social class, classes often have a distinct lifestyle that emphasises their class. The most powerful class in society often use markers such as costume, grooming, manners, and language codes that mark insiders and outside. Unique political rights such as honorary titles and concepts of social honour or face that are claimed to only be applicable to the in-group. But each class has distinctive features, often becoming defining elements of personal identity and uniting factors in group behaviour. French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu suggested a notion of high and low classes, with a distinction between bourgeois tastes and sensitivities and working class tastes and sensitivities. A New York Times special online interactive graphic tool called How Class Works, and you can go away and look this up, take the test yourselves, asks readers to find their own class position based on four key factors: occupation, education, income, and wealth. And these reflect some of the key elements that people generally refer to when they think about the definitions of class. And what gets confusing when you start to take this test is that it ranks you at a different level for each of these four factors. So I took the test and it showed that out of 100 percentiles, my education is in the 97th, my income is in the 78th, my wealth is in the 25th, and my occupation is in the 53rd. So it averages out at 63, which makes me middle class. Out of five possible options, bottom fifth, lower middle, middle, upper middle, or top fifth. I don't call it upper class. So if you took the test and you earned $100,000 a year working in a mine in Western Australia and you'd left school at the age of 15, you're also middle class. If you have a PhD and you work in a factory for $15 an hour, you're also middle class, according to these categories. But of course, anyone who's searched beyond Wikipedia and the New York Times, it is possible to do that, will discover that there are many different theories and debates about class. What class is, how many different classes there are, what are the defining features of class, whether classes still exist, and the role that class plays in society. And I grew up in Britain. Dean? Yeah. Here's some pictures of Britain. In the 1980s, and I became aware of class from a very young age and what it meant to be proudly part of a working class that was being viciously attacked by Britain's fighting lady, Margaret Thatcher, and how it was the only decent thing to do to direct your hatred towards people who had posh accents, who were members of this family, or anyone else who were lords and ladies and so on. And so in Britain today, actually, despite all the many attempts to create this ideological sense of a middle Britain, people are still pretty much tied to class identities. And there was a survey just a couple of years ago that found 57% of people in Britain consider themselves to be working class. And when I was growing up, I also had an image of what Australia was like, because I watched Neighbours every day. And I saw on Neighbours that things about class didn't seem to be quite so clear-cut. So there was Kylie Minogue, who was a blue-collar worker as a mechanic in a local car shop, whatever it's called. And there was Paul Robinson, white-collar, wearing owner of Lassiter's, the hotel and the business complex, the Empire, the evil character on Neighbours. But there weren't really these kind of aristocratic, posh-sounding upper class types, the same as we would see in Britain. So actually what Neighbours does is kind of builds on these theories of social class in Australia that have existed right from the beginning, since the invasion, that Australia is less of a class society. So in 1915, the Department of External Affairs told potential immigrants that if they came to Australia, they would find, and I quote, "the absence of that violent contrast between rich and poor, which is unfortunately so marked a feature in older lands." And today this rhetoric continues. Politicians from Pauline Hanson to Julia Gillard use this language around the Aussie battler, the hard-working family, and that's kind of counterposed to people who don't really work very hard or people who are a bit a cut above the rest, a bit elitist, a bit kind of snobby. And these divisions are not supposed to be seen in terms of economics or exploitation, but rather as features of the way that we relate as individuals, not even as social relations. And John Howard said in his Australia Day address in 2001, and this is quite remarkable, that, and he said, our social cohesion, flowing directly from a unique form of egalitarianism, is arguably the crowning achievement of Australia's experience over the past century. We remain a relatively classless society, aspirational yet egalitarian, competitive yet ultimately accommodating. Which is strange when you look at the fact that Australia is a country where over 2 million people live in poverty. Poverty means you don't have enough food to eat, you can't pay your bills. And actually this figure of the number of people living in poverty in Australia has been growing over the last 20 years. And actually if we use the same measures in Australia that they use in the European Union and the UK, we would find that about 3.8 million people in Australia live in poverty. And if you contrast this with the fact that executive pay last year rose by an average of $940,000. That's a 17.2% pay rise for the executives in Australia, while the annual wage of a full-time worker rose by around $3,000, about 5%. So profits last year went up by 27.5% to a record share of the national economy, while wages are the lowest share they have been since 1964. The median salary in Australia is around $55,000, and the average executive now earns about 100 times that average median salary. So the gap there between rich and poor in Australia is pretty clear. 200 households own wealth more than $200 million, and 27 households in Australia hold wealth of more than $1 billion. And Marxists in Australia have always been able to demonstrate that this has been the case, that there is a fully functioning system of economic class exploitation here in Australia. In 1894, the Australian Socialist League put it very clearly when they said that there are two great classes in society. The one, the capitalists, own land and capital. The other, the workers, own nothing except the power to labour. The modern wage earner receives only about one-third of the produce of his labour, the other two-thirds being taken by the capitalist who employs him. And this Marxist definition of class has remained the same ever since Marx and Engels came up with it, or developed it, over 150 years ago. So quite simply, the working class are those people in society who sell their labour, sell their work for a wage, and don't own any of the means of production, don't own land, factories, machinery, businesses, and so on. Workers don't have control over what they produce, over what they do in their workplace, or the hours, the location of their work. And so class is very clearly defined through the relations of production. Okay, so what about the blue-collar, white-collar thing? What do these terms mean? And does it make a difference within the working class if you're blue-collar or white-collar? So the term blue-collar emerged kind of around the middle of the 20th century as a way of describing industrial or manual workers on the basis of what they wear at work. So people wore dark blue shirts or overalls because, you know, it's okay to get that colour dirty, and that's seen in contrast with the white shirt of the office worker. So there's a few examples here. I'll just go through quickly to give you an idea. This is your 1940s... blue-collar factory worker in America. This is blue-collar factory workers in China today. It's pretty intense. This is an interesting one, the world's largest manufacturer of laptops. If you ever wonder how your laptop is being made, 38 million of them come out of this factory in Taiwan. So back to the 1940s, this was your first kind of stereotype of the white-collar workers. And here's some white collar workers today, or a couple of years ago, in a call center in India. So the terms blue collar and white collar kind of started from these definitions, but they've kind of expanded to And particularly in America, I think, to include certain kind of cultural references. So people talk about blue-collar neighborhoods, blue-collar bars. And actually, there's a kind of third collar that's emerging, the green collar, which is people who work in traditional blue-collar jobs but have a focus on environmental or renewable energy. So you may now start hearing about green-collar workers as well. And some stereotypes have emerged around the attitudes of blue-collar workers compared to white-collar workers. And theories have been developed about the relationship between blue and white-collar workers in terms of class struggle. And one of my main arguments today when I start to explore this in more detail will be that the relative conditions and experiences of blue and white-collar workers today have more in common than they ever have before. So critiques exist around what makes you working class and the role of working class that are levelled at Marxists. Challenges predictably come from those who are anti-Marxist, who are pro-capitalist or reformist, who want to maintain the status quo. But there are also some important challenges that we need to explore from those people who are anti-capitalist, who do want to change the world and see a different kind of system, but disagree with our analysis of the working class. And I think today, when we're witnessing revolution across the Arab world and general strikes and protests in Europe, then that horizon of major change seems closer now than it has been for decades, that we really need to come to grips with some of these arguments and some of these challenges. And the particular questions that I'm going to look at today are those that were beginning to be posed around the early 2000s. So theorists such as Hart and Negri in their book Empire, in Naomi Klein's much-read No Logo, that maybe some of you have read, and in the work of others since then who follow in these kind of postmodernist, post-structuralist traditions. So these writers use arguments about the changing nature and relationship of blue and white-collar workers around the world, along with shifts in the pattern of work and the kind of type and place and a whole range of different things, to come to a conclusion that the working class is no longer capable of occupying a central role in changing the world. So there's three main parts to their arguments, and I'm going to go through these three things. The first is that the working class has become deindustrialized. There are far fewer blue-collar workers than there have ever been before, and therefore there's less of the opportunity for those blue-collar workers to really disrupt industry and propose that and pose that direct challenge to their bosses. The second argument is that there's an increasing proportion of white-collar workers who are bought off by the system and therefore less likely to fight back and organise together in struggle with blue-collar workers. And the third argument is that there's been this globalisation of industry and change in the world of work that has meant that there's an increase in precarious or informal jobs, casualisation of jobs, leading to a weakening of the ability of the working class to come together to fight in times of struggle. So, are there really less blue-collar workers today? And we do hear a lot of this argument being made. You know, it's not the same as it used to be, that there are far less jobs in manufacturing and industry, you know, there's less blue-collar workers, and that capacity for people to have these really effective strikes that shut down businesses, that stop production, are just not the same as it was before. Well, if we look at the size of the industrial working class around the world, actually, that is right. It's not like it used to be. Actually, today around the world, there are more industrial workers and manual workers than there ever have been before. Even in the developed world, where this argument is more common, there hasn't actually been an overall shrinkage in this sector of workers. In the United States, the number of workers in industry was, in 98 was 20% higher than it was in 1971, with 31 million workers working in the industrial sector, and growth has also occurred in Japan. In the UK and France, there has been some reduction in the industrial working class, but still the global picture is that it is bigger than it ever has been before. In the United States, despite the downturn in the economy, the market for blue-collar workers is still expected to grow. The American Bureau of Labor Statistics estimated that between 2004 and 2014, there would be 40 million job openings for workers without a bachelor's degree, so workers who can work in the blue-collar sector. That's twice as many jobs as there will be for people with a degree, so the potential white-collar workers. Construction is expected to rise by 19%, and service-providing industries are anticipated to generate 14.5 million new jobs, which include things in retail trade, transporting, warehousing, professional scientific and technical services, and admin support and waste management. Now, some of these sectors start to raise some additional questions about how we define blue and white collar workers. Because a lot of these jobs that were formerly included in the industrial manufacturing sector are now counted as part of the service sector, which is counted as part of the white collar workforce. So today, some of the exact same workers who used to be considered blue collar workers are now part of the white collar working class. So in Britain, the Engineering Employers Federation argued that actually manufacturing in Britain could make up as much as 35% of the economy rather than the generally accepted 20% if it were measured using appropriate statistical definitions. So some of this decline in the industrial and manufacturing sector is due more to the definition of the types of work that people are doing than the reality of the situation itself. So these white-collar workers now include refuse workers, hospital ancillary workers, dockers, truck drivers, bus and tram drivers, train drivers, postal workers, and so on. And even if you look at the traditional, the background of some of the traditional white-collar workers in administrative roles and office jobs, actually, many of these more workers than before are from working class backgrounds who are in these jobs. So in the UK, if you look at the traditional white collar administrative jobs, most of these are occupied by women from working class backgrounds. So if you added these formerly blue collar, now white collar service sector jobs to the traditional blue collar jobs in the United States, you could actually you will find that it makes up about 75% of the total workforce. So the prediction is that in 5 years' time, the total workforce in America is 167 million people. 75% of that is 125 million manual or industrial workers in the United States. So with a total population of 300 million, you're talking about a very significant working class in a traditional sense. So even when we do see that the number of manufacturing jobs are decreasing, there is still that industrial strength in those who do still work in manufacturing. So that tactical strength when it comes to struggle on the basis of manufacturing jobs being the basis for all of that service sector as well, you can see that blue-collar strength is still there, and that overall industrial manual service sector is still very big. So what about the new army of white-collar workers? There's been a lot of arguments around the embourgeoisification, that is a word, Tom Bramble uses it, of the working class. And it's probably less common to hear these arguments today than it would have been 40, 50 years ago, when it was really stridently claimed that workers had become so comfortable in the 50s and 60s, you know, that they weren't ever going to challenge the system because actually they had it pretty good. But we do still hear this from time to time, even in Australia today, even in the situation of poverty and so on that I've outlined. You know, people have big plasma TVs, you know, they can afford to buy a house in Craigieburn, they go on holiday to the Gold Coast, like really, how could life be any better than this? So they're not going to want to change anything, and they're certainly not going to want to engage in any kind of militant struggle. And this is particularly aimed at people who are white-collar workers. You know, you don't even get your shirt dirty at work, you're probably not going to want to cause any trouble. So that's kind of how the argument goes. But just a cursory look at struggle around the world today, we actually see a picture which is entirely contrary to this theory, to these arguments. One of the biggest sectors of the white-collar working class, are people who work in the non-marketed services sector. So things like healthcare and education and the public service. And sometimes people think, oh, well, if you're not working in a job that directly generates profit, then, you know, it's a different kind of part of the working class. But that's not true either, because all of these jobs are still essential parts of running the capitalist system. So, you know, we need healthcare because we need healthy workers. We need education because we need trained and disciplined workers. And so all of these jobs are still fundamental in keeping capitalism ticking over. And actually, workers in these jobs hold considerable power when it comes to challenging the ruling class. And time again, we've seen nurses and teachers at the forefront of struggles. And I just wanted to take a quick look here in Victoria before broadening it out to the rest of Australia and the rest of the world. And I didn't know that much about some of these struggles. So the history of the nurses in Victoria shows that there's very little that's soft about people in the caring professions. In 1975, 4,000 nurses stormed Parliament in Melbourne with placards demanding better wages and conditions. That famous slogan, dedication doesn't pay the rent, started being used then. In 1986, there was a statewide strike of nurses in Victoria that lasted 5 weeks before the government did finally concede and they won that strike for better pay, contracts and conditions. And teachers also have a proud history of militancy. In 2004, teachers in Victoria took part in the biggest strike in their history. 30,000 teachers took part in that strike. 17,000 rallied in Parliament to demand pay rises, caps on class sizes, and an end to individual contracting arrangements. 25,000 teachers went on strike in 2008, and when we're seeing what's going to happen here with the Liberal government in Victoria, having promised that they were going to have the best paid teachers in Australia, and now saying, oh, we probably can't afford to do that, hopefully we'll see some further militancy from teachers here as well. Yes, there they are. You well remembered it. So this was a couple of the rallies at that time. They took over the Vodafone Arena in Melbourne. So, you know, they're militant. In Australia more broadly, the biggest union campaign that we can see happening today is being led by white-collar workers in the Australian Services Union in the Campaign for Equal Pay. And we've already seen thousands of workers take to the streets to protest against the Gillard government. And this year we know that there's going to be a series of further actions in that campaign. Just last week in Melbourne, I was kind of pleasantly surprised to see around 3,000 researchers out on this, out the front of the State Library protesting against cuts in funding for research in their white coats with their white collars. And when you look across Europe, it's white-collar public sector workers who are being the hardest hit by the cuts, the austerity measures, and who have been coming out in their thousands and hundreds and thousands and millions to fight back. So in Greece, it was the already low-paid public sector workers who were being hardest hit by the cuts there. 17,000 teachers were given the sack last September. In Italy, public sector pay was cut. In Spain, public sector pay was cut by 5%. In Britain, there's a public sector pay freeze, which is equivalent to a cut of about 10%. And there's the expectation that over the next year, 100,000 public sector workers in the UK will lose their jobs. And this will be repeated across Europe, and we're already seeing this. And in each of these countries, we're seeing white-collar workers fighting back and encouraging solidarity from their blue-collar counterparts. So we've seen general strikes in Italy, Spain, Greece, all led by public sector workers and their unions with millions taking part. These were some of the teachers who've been sacked in Greece who were at the forefront of the protests there. We all saw this on TV and in the papers and stuff, but yeah, public sector workers in their millions coming out. And in Britain, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw 500,000 workers and students in the biggest demonstration of its kind in protest. Well, it's just my favourite picture of the Greek general strike. No, the next one. Yeah. And then there's the British one there. Unison, which is the union that represents the majority of public sector workers, was, you know, the most represented at these rallies just a couple of weeks ago. And in America, you know, in Madison, Wisconsin, which we've heard about as well this weekend, it's teachers, public sector workers, who've led the struggle against attacks on their pay and conditions and their union rights. And you may have heard Sean Harkin or read in his interview about what's going on in Wisconsin, about the kindergarten teacher who was sitting next to him in the occupation, who was the person who started the chant, you know, this is class war. There's some great placards and stuff from teachers taking part in those protests as well. So clearly white-collar workers are capable of being militant in their struggle, just as capable as their blue-collar comrades. And I think with those kind of definitional changes and with the changes in the nature of work, that white-collar and blue-collar workers are arguably closer together than they ever have been before. So the final argument that I'm just going to come to is probably the one that we get presented most in debates around the nature of the working class. So this is the argument that says there's a trend towards casualisation of work and an increase in the number of precarious or informal jobs that really fatally weakens the ability of the working class in times of struggle. And it appears kind of common sense that this is a pattern that we're seeing, and we do hear about this quite a lot. But actually, if you go and explore the discourse and the data around employment insecurity over the last decade, there is some confusion about this and some disagreement. And there's some confusion about the concept of employment insecurity itself and different ways that people measure these things. So it's not entirely clear what the data is telling us, but I have found a number of studies that argue that actually employment insecurity is kind of overemphasized when it comes compared to the reality of the situation. So a study in the Cambridge Journal of Regions, Economy and Society by Francis Green found that between 1997 and 2005, the proportion of jobs that are perceived insecure actually went down significantly in Western and transitional economies. And actually, these changes had more to do with a reduction in unemployment than anything else. And she argued that as a result of, you know, and you can go around and read all the data, I won't go through it all, but she argued that there are thus no grounds for accepting that, at least over this relatively short period, workplaces are going through a sea change in the security of employment. Either the onset of an age of insecurity or a developing disjuncture between perceptions of insecurity and the reality of unemployment. There is little support in previous empirical studies for the claim that there has been a radical secular increase in the experience of employment insecurity in modern capitalism. And if you think about it ideologically, if convincing enough arguments can be made that job insecurity is the only possible direction of change, then workers are forced to accept an end to jobs for life and put pressure on to acquire flexible skills and to accept the situation that you're going to have to sell yourself in different ways on the market as a worker. And rather than looking to trade unions to protect your job security or governments to try and protect jobs in general. And people who make these theoretical arguments have a tendency to set out these trends in insecurity in pretty grandiose terms, which when you actually explore and examine the data, bear not very much relation to the empirical reality. Tom Bramble conducted a very thorough review of the Australian data around job security, and he showed that standard jobs, the 38-hour-a-week ongoing permanent contracts, are still by far the dominant form of job for most Australian workers. And people still stay in jobs for, and this kind of surprised me, on average the Australian worker will stay in the same job for 7 years. And that's actually low compared to European workers. So in the UK, the average is 9 years. 11 years in Germany and 12 years in Italy and France. So some of this kind of perceived wisdom or what we're told about employment insecurity, actually when you look at some of the facts, is not necessarily the case. And I do have a graph from Tom's thing. So you'll see this is since 1992 up until 2010. The number of permanent full-time jobs has gone down, but you could compare the gap between that and casual part-time, permanent part-time, and casual full-time. I mean, the number of casual full-time jobs is really a tiny proportion of the total number of jobs in Australia. So there are some changes in the nature of the workforce and changes in work today. And that has always been the case as long as capitalism has existed, that these changes continue to be made. But the difference today is that some people argue that these kind of changes have meant that the working class is not a force that can pose a collective threat to capitalism. Laurie Penny, who's a New Statesman blogger and writer, posed some of these arguments in a debate with Alex Kalinikos, who's from the Socialist Workers Party in the UK, during the student protests last year, to show and to argue that actually building a revolutionary party today based on the organised working class is now an impossibility. She argued that the structures of labour and power and information distribution have changed irrevocably since the 1980s, which is why the structures of solidarity and revolution have to change too. The power of the organised labour was undercut across the world by building in higher structural unemployment, holding down wages, atomising workers, outsourcing and globalising production, while keeping working people tied to increasingly divided and suspicious communities. Thatcher, Reagan and Blair deregulated oppression. In order to be properly effective, rebels have to deregulate themselves, she argued. And one of the impacts of the global financial crisis has been that employers can force people into more flexible working arrangements, clearly something that benefits bosses rather than workers. And increasing levels in unemployment may correlate with increasing levels of employment insecurity. But by far the majority of workers are still in secure jobs. And the demands of the modern economy mean that fewer, more skilled workers are needed rather than large numbers of unskilled workers. So those with low-paid or insecure jobs are not necessarily being super exploited. It's just that capitalists can't find ways to squeeze enough profits out of them, so they often don't bother to try. That's why we see many areas of the developing world, workers either find themselves the option of being kind of self-employed or employed at an extremely low wage, kind of at the fringes of the capitalist system. Okay, so the other thing that people argue about insecure workers is that they are less likely to fight back, are less likely to be involved in union activity or want to risk their insecure jobs. The other side to that argument is that if you're in an insecure job, that you're much less likely to see yourself as part of the family kind of sense of the business or have some kind of loyalty to your company, which can make you more likely to struggle, in fact. And it also ignores the many historical and current examples of casual workers, of these insecure workers, who have been some of the most militant in times of struggle. An example of some massive militancy by this insecure workforce took place in South Korea in the 1980s in textile firms, where it was the informal workplace, the insecure workers, who led strikes to some really significant victories. If you haven't heard of that before, I would recommend having a closer look or having a look at that. Closer to home, last year there was a strike by Visy workers in Australia, and you may have heard about that, but you may not have realised that a whole bunch of those workers were casual workers, were workers in insecure jobs who were fighting back against the company's attempt to freeze their pay and further casualise the workforce. And if you went to Liam Ward's talk about union organising today, which I didn't, but I'm just guessing here, you probably will have heard, I'm sure he would have talked about how some of the most militant activists in his university are people employed on casual contracts. And actually, Liam himself was a casual for many years. I think he's only just got a contract, and he's been the most militant worker in his union. So those kind of arguments about, oh, well, if you're casual, if you're insecure, you're not going to fight back, don't stand up against all of these examples either. And often, I think, are used by unions as an excuse not to try to bother to organise casual or informal workers. Okay, so I'm just going to finish up. And, you know, I'm not trying to make an argument to deny that there's been changes in the composition of the workforce or that there hasn't been some kind of reorganisation of the workplace in Australia and internationally. But the point I'm trying to make is that the working class is far from fading away. The working class is growing around the world. Sections of the working class are not becoming privileged at the expense of others. White-collar workers are not this passive group of workers who are unwilling to fight back. Blue-collar workers still exist. They're still a strong force in the West, in Australia, in the developed world. And the working class have shown themselves to be central to the success of revolution that's happening right now in the Middle East, that you'll hear about and have heard about in other sessions. That's why I haven't talked about it so much here. So the power of workers always has and always will be in our ability to work and in our ability not to work and halt the generation of profits almost instantly. So in Australia, when bosses pay an average of $45,000 a year to employ workers, they get a profit of $20,000 a year on average per worker that they employ. That's a 60% return. Workers are still by far the best investment that people can make. And people have talked about the mining workers in Australia generating a profit in New South Wales of around $1 million per worker. And on average in Australia, they are the highest profit-making workers with around $500,000 profit from every mining worker. So no workers equals no profit. That's where the power of the working class lies. And as revolutionaries, we have to continue to look to the working class as the central force in revolutionary change, because we can be left with no doubt that the people on the other side, the ruling class, across Europe and around the world, are conscious of fighting in a class war. And you better believe that they're fighting to win. Warren Buffett, who's the third richest person in the world, said in 2005 that, yes, there is a class war, and we are going to win. So as workers, we must continue to be conscious of our class struggle as the forces on the other side. And all workers around the world are part of the same system of exploitation. We have to fight together, and as a collective class, I hope that we win together. Yeah.